Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined today, back in the studio, Josh Blank, Texas Politics Project director. He'll be here wearing a couple of hats today.
Ooh, I love multiple hats.
But how about wigs? How you feel about wigs, Lessa?
Depends on the color.
Okay.
I'm feeling.
Yes, if you're in a wig mood. So, we want to talk about it's the 20th Texas Lyceum poll.
Yeah, that's right.
Which you worked on, released just yesterday as we record here on Thursday. Right?
Yeah.
It went public yesterday,
yeah, yesterday
right?
Yep.
I know you guys did the appearance. I didn't know the docs were out. I went back in the archive and found the press release from the first Lyceum poll in 2007, which I worked on with Darren and Ross with, quotes from me and Shaw in a press release, almost certainly the handiwork of Ross Ramsey at the time.
That's a pleasure though.
That was
Ross Ramsey would write no offense to anybody, but just in my life, I wish Ross Ramsey would write more press releases for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would take it.
I think he's probably out of that market now.
Ross, if you're listening.
Everybody's got a price.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we jump in the Lyceum stuff, a couple of big stories that have been percolating in the Texas news this week that I think do kind of speak to the mood check that is, in the Lyceum data. The first is... And part of this is just going back and referencing things we've talked about a lot on the podcast. And this is Governor Abbott leaning on Houston, Dallas, and Austin to modify limitations that those cities have put on police cooperation with ICE.
Mm-hmm.
Limitations, some parameters on that. And promising to withhold state grant money if they don't comply. Austin, $2.5 million for, near as I can tell, mostly non-directly enforcement-based kind of programs. But Houston, $110 million. So something that somebody had to do something about.
They seem to jump pretty quick.
And the Houston City Council has, led by the mayor, former Senator Whitmire, who had voted for the modifications signed off on them along with the city council. Now, essentially messaging, we don't have a lot of choice here.
Yeah.
Ultimately, because of the size of that money, the World Cup coming up, et cetera. Dallas on the hook for $82 million. A little bit of pushback so far from some leadership in Dallas, but a little unclear. They've not acted as quickly as Houston has, at least to my knowledge. Mayor Watson pushing back pretty vocally, but hard not to notice that also, despite the fact that the Austin City Council is now facing some pretty big budget questions that are very ripe right now, a little more latitude when you're looking at a $2.5 million hit as opposed to a $110 million hit.
Yeah, and I think, of course, we can't ignore the obvious political overlay on a lot of this, which is, you kind of make the point here, the dollar figures differ. And the specificity of these all differ based on, what the previous agreements were and what the police stations were doing and what the councils were directing them to do or not do. And in most cases, my understanding, a lot of this has to do with how long local police will hold on to someone, basically to wait for ICE, and not to be mundane about it, but I will. It's to some degree, this is also a budget issue, for a lot of these local policing entities when it comes to the, you know, the jail populations, like how long they're going to hold someone for ICE to pick them up. And with, you know, efforts at increased enforcement, you know, some would say, you know, the counter argument, well, look, this is an unfunded mandate. So like, we're just trying to like figure out how to do this. And that's why I think the reaction from the cities have been a little bit kind of like, well, okay, fine. You know, in some sense, it's like, sure, we'll rewrite this ordinance a little bit so that like, you know, but also it reflects the fact that, you know, for Abbott, when, you know, you're looking for, we've talked about this a lot, when you're looking for opportunities to be able to talk about immigration and border security because it's such a core issue to your party, but you can't talk about the border, you can't talk about federal enforcement, you're kind of left with this sort of...
Right, which is obviously why I kind of flagged it.
But it's interesting because of that.
We've talked quite a bit about what Republican candidates in Texas, we've talked about it nationally, but... Also, but mainly what Republican candidates in Texas are going to run on, given the shift that we've talked about in public opinion and public attention to immigration and the border relative to economic issues that are very tough for Republicans right now. And then this obviously also, you know, speaks to the ongoing dynamic between state government and localities. So it echoes a lot of things. Yeah. I mean, the main reason I raised it was it does seem... Partially an answer to the question of, or at least a data point in the question about how Republican candidates in Texas are going to be able to tap into the issues that are the issue in immigration and the border that is just so critical to unifying Republicans at a time when they are both looking for something to campaign on that's not...
Yeah.
You know, that avoids talking about the down parts of the economy and also speaks to where their voters are.
Well, I think I'm glad you brought this issue up because I think in some ways it shows what a stretch that they're making. Because if you really think about it, like the governor's office with respect to powers related to local police and local police enforcement, the reality is the legislature passed a law pretty recently that made it an impossibility for localities to decrease their police budgets. And yet the governor's threat in the face of local, you know, intransigence on this issue is to take away money from the police, which is just an odd sort of outcome to this. I mean, as you sort of...
And we should say, you know, intransigence is...
Yeah, I mean...
You know, the word being, you know, the position probably of the governor's office. And, you know, when... if you look at the adjustments made in Houston... Civil rights groups and civil liberties groups have to be, say, this is a retreat and it's terrible. The adjustments are not huge.
Right.
In terms of the language of the directions and the policy guidance.
Yeah, I just think it's going to be – I think this is probably going to – I don't know how long this is going to last. It's probably going to kind of die on the vine because the cities are pretty willing to just kind of move on from this.
I think that's right.
But it's also the case – I mean, how long would the governor really want to hold on to a position of reducing police budgets in Texas?
Well,
cities?
I mean, I think that it has given – the leadership of the cities or the opponents of the governor, the opportunity to say, well, who's defunding the police now?
Right. That's exactly.
Now, you know, I think it's
silly,
not.
But it's not.
It's a little, you know, it's a little glib and I get that, but it's also sitting right there.
Yeah.
And at the same time that it's a little glib, it would also be political malpractice not to use that line. So the other story, a little more directly election related, a little less pregnant with implications, I think, but still worth noting is that I saw it first this morning in Punch Bowl News. Texas Tribune also has an article, was flagged in the Clips and Quorum report, I think. I don't remember what the source was, but news that the two of the big national partisan congressional funding entities, PACs, announced investments in media buys, particular media buys earlier this week, yesterday, day before, in various congressional races, which is kind of the part of the campaign season maneuvering. Some of this is sending, some of it is just the thing itself. They're making the buys. The buys can be ascertained. Some of it is also feints where the parties are also positioning a little bit of like a game of risk. They're moving, I'm going to move a couple of armies to Yakutsk or something, right? But probably about three people to get that reference, but that's okay. So, but the targets are interesting. No big surprises. It's all kind of focused on the fallout of the redistricting battle here. Also very much in the news this week, given the vote in Virginia, which went the Democrats' way, kind of connected to this. But the numbers and the targets are a little bit interesting. So the House Majority PAC on the Democratic side spending about $22 million in ad buys in five Hispanic districts. The suspects you would assume, the Cuellar and Vicente Gonzalez districts, 28 and 34. But then also 15, 23, and 35, the De La Cruz, the now open seat in CD 23.
23 one becomes interesting.
And then the new District 35, drawn to be a majority Republican district, mm-hmm. or the Central Texas. And then on the Democratic side, the Congressional Leadership PAC spending 13.9 to shore up 28 and 34. So spending money on Vicente Gonzalez and Henry Cuellar. So, you know, no real rocket science yeah. here. Not a lot of, you know, not a ton of tea leaves to read here. But notable that we've been talking a lot about how our expectation has been that this redistricting would trigger national attention, outside money to the seats.
Yeah.
It's happening.
I do wonder, you know, the one.
Most of these, I think, are fall ad buys, I should say.
Yeah. And I would say the one piece of news in there, I think, is, I, you know, the sort of the counterfactuals. You can't know. But I mean, I wonder if they would have bought in 23 before the Gonzalez resignation. And now, given that state, I mean, I wonder, you know, if that's a little bit more, he looks a little bit more on offense in that sense going into 23, yeah. given what the way that district has looked. And but given the lineup of the candidates now, it makes sense. So right. interesting.
And I expect, you know, people will be watching that race in D.C. and there will be outside money if they get even a glimmer that.
Yeah, I mean that's a tough district though because it is just
It was redrawn to be a very R district, is what I think we discussed.
Yeah, it's a very R district and it's super super spread out. So I mean, in terms of like how that money gets.
It's at one point it was the largest, and I think it still is the largest non-state.
Yeah.
District in the country. Yeah. That district's always been a bear, always been interesting. And there is an interesting piece of this is the more people map drawers try to make that safe, it's that district is hard to maintain.
Yeah,
in that way.
Well, I mean,
or has been historically.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, and we've talked about this, is that a lot of the Republican success in South Texas, you know, outside of, you know, really narrow current you know, reasons having to do with the president, having to do with, you know, party performance, blah, 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 has to do with the fact that Republicans have done a much better job finding conservative rural voters in those parts of the district
right.
that also happen to be Hispanic in a lot of cases.
And getting them out.
Yeah, and getting them out. But if you take them from one place, then put them in 23, well, then they're not in these other districts. And that's where, you know, the fallout comes. So that's interesting.
So both of these, I mean, that second story, clearly directly a campaign story. But the first one, more of a governance story, but with very strong campaign overtones. And both of which tell us interesting things about the state of play. And so that brings us back to the poll you worked on for the Lyceum, just released. So I want to talk about the findings and the underlying intent. So tell us a little about the design and the intent of the poll. So design in terms of methods, but also, you know, what did the Lyceum want from this poll?
Yeah, sure. So real quick, just, you know, in terms of, you know, the Lyceum, I mean, for those of you who aren't aware of who the Lyceum is, you know, it's a leadership organization in the state. I think it's been around since 1980. They have a class of what they call directors every year. It's sort of a selective group of people who essentially want to be engaged in, I think, you know, the state issues, state development, you know, essentially, you know, the quality of the state going forward, I would say writ large, economically, you know, politically, you know, quality of life wise, all these things. And so then to do this, they have a number of conferences each year, usually four, one public conference, sometimes five conferences around certain topics, usually topics facing the state, right. large and small. So it can range from, you know, the wine and spirits industry to like pension reform. I mean, literally, you know.
Those two could be linked.
Especially if you stay the whole day. And so part of, you know, this now for the last 20 years has been to have a statewide poll of Texas adults as part of the overall sort of information gathering exercise and as a part of these discussions. Sometimes the poll is more focused on one particular issue, like a big issue, for example, during COVID or something like that. Other times, it's really connected to the different topics of the different conferences, which themselves generally cover a lot of state issues. Like the UT poll, because it's been around for a while, there is, you know, a fair amount of trend in the poll. But the main thing to note, and I think the real thing that differentiates this from a lot of, you know, other surveys, both here in Texas, but also really in most places, is that it's a survey of Texas adults, right? And so it's not registered voters. It's not likely voters. We're not looking at the Republican primary electorate. We're looking at the Texas population, the adult population. And that's really meaningful here because we talk about this all the time, the fact that, you know, yeah, Texas is one of the youngest, most diverse states in the country. And then you say, well, what about the registered voter population? It's like, oh, well, that's majority white. You know, what about the likely voter population? It's like, oh, yeah, that's older and you know, whiter still relative to the overall population. Right. And so this is a nice way, at least, you know, for me, once a year to go and look at the broader pool, right? And so to do that, we use a 1,200-person mixed mode survey. 1,000 respondents are contacted by phone, the majority of those by cell phone, obviously. And then we have a 200-person oversample of unregistered adults that we contact online, because ultimately, when you call people and try to have them take a survey, they're more likely to be registered than the average person in the population. Sure. So we go and we seek those out. Obviously, anyone can take the survey in English or in Spanish at their discretion, and then we weight the final data set to be representative to the joint distribution of race and ethnicity, age, and gender according to the most recent data provided by the Texas State Demographic Center. So like our 1,200-person survey, the margin of sampling error is 2.83%, larger, you know, sampling error for subgroups. Yeah, that's okay. There we go.
So talk about so what was the mandate here? This was,
yeah.
I mean, I've heard you summarize it and and kind of looking at it. I mean, there's a kind of quality of life, but also state of play in Texas. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's an interest in infrastructure broadly understood and thinking about, you know, essentially the state's economic development going forward. And the state has some pretty specific economic development plans going forward. And that was definitely front of mind and kind of thinking about the design of the survey. At the same time, you know, this is something like you and I talk about all the time. It's like, you know, most ordinary people don't have like a ton of attitudes about the ports.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. And so you have to sort of think about this from the context of what are the attitudes and opinions that regular everyday Texans can bring to some of these discussions that we're having about, you know, career readiness, you know, thinking about infrastructure from the perspective of the people who are actually using the infrastructure, right? Yeah. And things like that. And then also some of these quality of life issues that, again, touch on the conferences, but I think also speak to some of these broader things about, you know, okay, we can talk about home ownership, we can talk about roads and jobs and the economy, really unpack some of that stuff. But also, like, you know, are you going on vacation, right? Like, you know, hey, is that a job or a career, or is it, you know, is this like something else, right? And that allows us to go a little bit deeper. And I think, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, sort of in the sense of like what we do in public opinion and the nature of, you know, the information environment being so fractured and like the growth in the word vibes, you know, it's like you can't, it's hard to like, it's almost like the growth in that is almost a reflection of the fact that as things get so spread out, you almost have to kind of take a step back now. It's like, what are the vibes? Let's just talk generally what this looks like. Uh-huh. And in a sense, I think this poll really gets at, uncovers a little more of the vibes of the state that we see in the registered voter polls that we do. But in some ways, it cracks it open a little bit more because we are getting people who aren't registered to vote, who fall into sort of these other demographic groups that are actually, you know, they're going to be an increasingly large share of the state population.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that, and I've not dug into this as deeply as you have, obviously, but, you know, there are some cross currents here.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, what you guys found in terms of general economic assessments doesn't seem much different than what we're seeing elsewhere, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, if you want to talk about, you know, the highlights, but basically,
yeah,
you know, more people think the economy is worse off, you know, than it is better.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing year over year snapshots. And in general, you know, what you saw was last year there was a little bit more optimism, right? I think, you know, with the new administration, there was an assumption that, you know, essentially the orientation towards business, I mean, towards industries that, you know, potentially are important in the state, which we can talk about, actually, it's in the survey. You know, we're going to see a bit of a rebound and that was going to be good. And now, you know, we're still dealing with high prices. There's the sort of the question of the impact that tariffs has had on that. There's the question of the impact, you know, that the war is currently having on that. And so that's all in there. But I think what this also does is it, you know, one of the things that this is useful, and it's one of the things I really like to do in our survey too, is by looking at the changes over time, we can see how the state is doing on some of the big issues that like they've been talking about, right? I mean, we talk about like, you know, state leaders, and this is where it's good to kind of get outside of just the voters who hear the messages and kind of into these broader communities. So, I mean, just to sort of jump into some of this, you know, in terms of these quality of life discussions, what we mean by this, right? You know, I sort of set this up in this way because I thought it was really interesting. You know, the 2025 Lyceum poll, 81% of Texas adults said that they considered themselves to be Texan, which I think is, you know, and that's higher than in other states when looked for some comparison points. And that's like to be expected, but like you want to know that that's true. It is true. Texans are more likely to consider themselves to be Texans.
Even if they're not.
Even if they're not. Even if they just got
according here. According to, you know, the more stringent definitions.
Right. You know, so 75% are proud of Texas's history, and 72%, this was the key one, you know, said that despite its problems, Texas is the best place to live in America. And so it's like, okay, well, that's useful, right? Let's think about that a little more. And so, you know, there's a lot you could talk about in terms of quality of life. And, you know, I tended to just sort of focus on a couple things, which was, you know, how does Texas look as a place to like find a job, buy a home, raise a family, right? And we have a bunch of items in the survey that can talk to this and also over time. And what we found was, you know, unfortunately for the state, is we're seeing sort of a decline in most of these attitudes, right? So what we found was that, you know, 47% of Texans rated the local availability of good jobs, so in their communities, as either excellent or good, but that's down 12 points from just 2023.
Yeah.
Right? Only 9% rated, you know, local availabilities for jobs as excellent or good. Like, that's 1 in 10 people. That's not great in terms of the way that we talk about Texas and the business environment, right? We find here, you know, about 1 in 4 Texans say that basically they need more education or training if they want to get into a job or career that they want. And only 1 in 4 Texans say that they're in a career. So the same share of Texans say that they're in a career, which is not high. 1 in 4 say, yeah, I need more. Like, I need more education, more training. And the remainder are either retired or are basically just trying to, just getting by in the job that they're in.
Did you go back and look and see how that tracked with the higher ed poll we were doing a few
years
ago?
I need to. I mean, there's no like access to talk about it in this, but it would be interesting to look at it and maybe write something.
Because my gut feeling is that's pretty similar to what we were getting when we were doing that. WGU.
Yeah, I think
cut, et cetera, poll.
Let's when I finish.
It's been a few years. Yeah, keep going.
No, but what I want to do when we come back, I want to put a pin in something. The challenge in terms, I think, for politicians and the idea of like, you know, a big infrastructure stuff.
Yeah.
Because you'll see it, you know, in some of this. So then housing, right? You know, half of Texans rate the availability of housing in the area where they live is excellent or good, and that's down 7 points from 4 years ago when it was 57%. But it's notably higher, actually, than the share who rated the opportunities for home ownership, right? Two different things, availability for housing, opportunities for home ownership. So availabilities for housing, half say it's excellent or good, getting down. Opportunities for home ownership, 43% say it's excellent or good, and that's down 10 points since 2023. So in 2023, a majority said, you know, we've got houses, you know, at least. Now it's on the other side of that.
Which is interesting and a little, yeah.
Well, you know, so I'll jump into
interesting given where the real estate market is.
Well, it's interesting, you know, one of the things we saw with another question we ask that we've been asking regularly is, you know, basically, do you agree or disagree with the following statement? I spend too much of my income on housing. And back, you know, in 2020, a majority of Texans disagreed with that statement. Basically, 55% said no. In the last few surveys, it's been north of 60% say, yes, I spend too much of my income on housing. For renters, it's 71%.
Yeah.
However, now this is like within the margin of error. It dropped a little bit from the last time we asked it, from like 63 to 60%. And that probably does reflect the fact that there has been, like, I mean, we can talk in Austin.
A little bit of a cooling.
There's been a little bit of a cooling. There's been a lot of building,
a lot of cooling,
especially market rate housing or market rate apartments have been building a lot in a lot of places. But there's a difference between sort of available housing on the one hand and like ability to own a home on another. And that's, you know, that's why that gap is meaningful, I think, you know, in ways that I think we can all kind of understand. And then, you know, one of the surprising ones, and this is one, you know, I feel bad we weren't asking about it sooner, and I have some theories why we don't have to go into it. But, you know, really during the pandemic, the issue of childcare started coming up a lot more.
Yeah.
And I think partially because issues of childcare started to expand to more and more people. And so it became a bigger interest, I think, amongst, you know, people who maybe had
even if
thought.
A relatively small share of most samples.
Yeah, it's a small share of most samples, but it became a more of a salient issue overall. So 46% of Texans rate their local access to childcare positively, and that's down 18 points since 2023. And I think that tracks with a lot of stories we've seen. I mean, Austin has specifically made some efforts to like remove property taxes for childcare facilities, like things that they can do to try to make this industry a little bit more competitive. And so there are other places where we saw these sort of similar gaps and sort of drops in evaluations. But overall, you kind of go across it and you say, yeah, you know, Texans like Texas, but when you look at all of these sort of key things, you know, there's other ones I'm not going to mention now, but like satisfaction with the quality of the roads, you know, is down, right? Reliability and cost of electricity, down, which is interesting, right? Concern about the water supply is about half, about 47 to 49% of people. And what's interesting about that is it remains high. It's a little bit lower than it was, which again, kind of makes sense in that there's been investments in water. Like, you know, we have,
yeah,
but it's actually the same level of concern as Texans expressed about the safety and reliability of the food supply, which is sort of, in some sense, kind of an interesting sort of sub-story to this that I don't, you know, with water running out in Corpus Christi, it makes sense for people to be on, like that to be on people's mind. The idea that the food supply was a similar level of concern was definitely a surprise in this poll, but it overall reflects the fact that while the state has been trying to address a number of these problems, as well, I'll come back to that, put the pin in, you know, most big infrastructure projects take a long time. So one, to be able to actually produce the thing that you say you're going to do takes a long time. But also the production of good roads means, you know, you don't notice you're sitting in traffic. You know, the production of a really reliable water system means you don't get a boil water notice this year, which one in four Texans did, which is kind of a non-event. You know, the electricity staying on is a non-event.
Yes.
And so there's sort of, there's an asymmetry here between both the scope and the scale of the problems and the timeline in terms of the state trying to address it. And in some sense, you are seeing a little bit in some areas where you've seen consistent, sustained effort, like around water, maybe around electricity, to see a little bit slightly less negative perceptions. But on all these other big things, you are still seeing, you know, kind of this decline in evaluations that, you know, I mean, we'll see if it keeps going or if it rests.
Yeah. I'm wondering about that food supply question.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering how people read reliability now in retrospect, probably, because that's a pretty high reading for what I think you were asking.
Yeah, I think there's reasons you could justify that set of results, and there's reasons you could question it, I think. You know,
I mean, how much of that is just price stuff bleeding into that response?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too.
You know, I don't know, but it does stand out in the
safety
same way.
Was up there, too, though, on that one. So reliability and safety, I think.
Okay.
So that was sort of the vibey piece of it. You know, I think there's I think one of the things that I'm sort of thinking, I'll sort of throw this back to you maybe to think about, is how much of this is falling out of overall just sort of negative sentiment, you know, kind of about the direction of the country, about, you know, the economy. And so therefore, you know, that's just bleeding into more general negative evaluations of everything. Or do we think that these things are just, you know, I mean, the most positive way to put it is, hey, Texas has been really successful drawing a lot of people here, you know,
and
the infrastructure's under strain, you know.
And yeah, we've talked about some of the ambivalent responses to growth that we've seen and some of the other polling we've done for the UT poll. I mean, I was thinking that as you were going through that and talking about, you know, all the we love Texas, we identify with Texas stuff, and then, you know, less optimistic or less positive readings on the general environment. It does feel to me, or makes sense to me, I guess is a better, slightly more robust way of putting that the wrestling with that is another form of something that we've talked about a lot in here, which is going into the election season, not to be monomaniacal about the election, but on one hand, there's definitely a negative vibe in the national environment, no matter, you know, how much the president's supporters are saying that's, I mean, it's showing up too uniformly in all the numbers at all level. And then there's, for the election in Texas, there's the organic Texas thing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, we were talking, I think I was talking to Bayless Wagner about it last week a little bit, but on the podcast, but there is this question about how Texas candidates are going to position themselves in a way that enables them to continue to exploit the positive stuff you found.
Right.
And avoid the political costs of the negative stuff, that part of which is situation on the ground.
Yeah.
As we're talking about. And part of which has to be, at least in part, the overwhelmingly negative economic sentiment out there.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, this is not a poll that's designed to be political. And in fact, you know, one of the things that's not in this poll, which is great, is there's no trial ballots in here. We're looking at Texas adults. But I mean, one of the things that, you know, was just sort of stuck out to me in terms of the, you know, maniacal focus on the election was the most important problem facing the U.S. And this is an open-ended question. So again, it's 1,200 Texas adults. They can say whatever they want, okay? If you look across the top issues and you basically take The war in Iran, which was number one at 19%. Inflation and rising prices was 15%. The economy was 12%. The Trump presidency was 10%. Political corruption and leadership was 6%. Energy and gas prices was 3%. If you add those up, that's 65%. If you think unity and division of the country at 4% could go, you know, one way or the other, fine, let's say 67%. But that's two-thirds of adults in Texas saying something that can be pretty easily tied or directly relates to the current administration. Right.
Fodder for Democratic campaigns.
Yeah, and that's what people are telling us. You know, and that's high. I mean, you know, we think about, like, what about the, illegal immigration, 6%, right? And that was the highest thing I just didn't mention there.
Right.
So, I mean, like, that really stood out. I mean, in terms of when you're thinking about the mood, the environment, this notion of, you know, how do you sort of rely on this argument? Like, hey, keep...
And the Texas most important problem facing the state were not super different, right?
No, they weren't super different. And so...
As I recall looking at that.
Yeah. And so how do you, you know, maintain sort of this idea of, hey, you know, keep Texas, right? Stay the course. But, you know, you're looking at all this stuff. I mean, one of the sort of the kind of... I don't know. Like, I mean, one of the, you know, I would say the headline result of the thing, if you were going to say there's a, I don't like using that term because I think there's a lot of headline results in here, actually. So feel free to call me. But like, only 27% of Texans expect their children to be better off economically than they are. And that was the lowest that it was tied for lowest in the time series.
Right.
It was lower than we saw during the housing collapse in 2008, 2009. Like, it was low. Now, again, some of that is acute of the time, of the moment, right? But also, like, you know, we're asking people to take a step back and think, you know, about opportunities. And that's kind of troubling. I mean, I think in the sense of, you know, the idea of Texas is this place where you can come, we've got a good economy, we've got plenty of housing, you know, we can fit you in, you know, it's going to be great. And if, you know, the residents themselves are sort of questioning what the value proposition is here, that's going to be a tougher and tougher sell. And we always talk about this, like, in terms of, you know, again, going back to the politics. You know, you can't, you know, if somebody believes the sky is red, you can't tell them it's blue, and they're not going to listen to you. Right. And so it's the same sort of thing here. If you say, like, everything's great, the economy's humming along, you know, the biggest problem actually is, you know, whatever, wokeness.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people are going to think you're kind of crazy. Right. And so this is the challenge I think, you know, Republicans are still kind of facing here because, and in fact, the adult sample really highlights it in some ways that usually you don't always see. But in some ways, this actually crystallizes it. Usually, you know, the adults are a little bit less focused than the registered voter sample is a little bit more engaged. And in this, it's almost like the amount of focus is kind of surprising.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what I said before, I guess, I mean, I think this really does sort of capture, you know, where the challenges are if you're running in Texas, but also where the governance challenges are too. And you know, one thing that was interesting, that the intensity of the water concern, to go back for just a second,
yeah,
to just pull that out as an example, was actually outside the margin, I think, decreased.
Yeah.
Just the people that said they were very or extremely concerned, whatever the language was on that.
Right.
And I want, you know, I just wonder as we go through this endless And for good reason, infrastructure discussion, and by endless, that characterizes it the wrong way. I should put it this way. The constant challenge in the legislature to remain, to keep some focus on the big infrastructural issues, mm-hmm. whether you're spending on them every session or not, and the way that those challenges are out there. And in our front and center in the legislative arena, they're not front and center in social media, you know, partisan social media or any of that,
yeah.
But they are front and center in the legislature. As we're recording this, state affairs is in the House, is having their hearing on electric issues, implementation of legislation from last time, where all that's in. And all that is just out there in a way that is, you know, a little bit difficult for the campaign environment. And again, so what have we been seeing? We've been seeing different kinds of issues, and it's still not clear to me what's really going to emerge.
No.
You know, as we get closer to the fall, as the focal point, and why would it emerge now? But
to your point on that, you know, I mean, the concern went down, you know, like a statistically significant amount. But part of it is, you know, I think you go back to the experiential piece, which is, you know, 2024, a third of Texans said they'd experienced a boil water notice in the last year. Now we're down to 26%, which is better, you know. But
you not know, really where you want it.
No, it's nothing that no one's going to go run out and say, "Hey, we did it, guys." But I mean, but like that difference is actually that's an appreciable difference, right? Because and to say that's like it's not to say that you know the 8% of people is the difference because it reverberates out. It's about the stories. It's about it may not be your town, but like if the town over doesn't have water today, like you hear about it. You have people driving over. So it has an effect. And so I think the fact that like, you know, I mean, just to say realistically, people have to, I mean, to your point, people have taken these issues seriously within the constraints they face. You know, you could say whether the water investment that we've done, you know, after the last constitutional amendment, like whether it was the right number, whether it was enough, it was still a large number to try to deal with the problem.
It was a legislative lift.
It was a legislative lift. And I think it's also the case we have a lot of localities who are spending a lot of time and effort trying to deal with these issues. And so you actually are seeing it in the numbers. The challenge is just that like people are still really worried. And I think as we know, as people have studied public opinion, that slight abatement and concern can flip in a second easily. Right.
Right. Recency bias goes both ways.
Exactly.
Cuts both ways.
Right.
Right. So, you know, to kind of move into another big picture aspect. What did you make of you guys have done a time series and asked several times now, I think, about support for democracy in this poll. And I'm curious, you know, talk a little bit about what you got and how it fits into this. It does seem to fit into the overall picture here.
Yeah.
One might want to paint.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, it's one of the other things that we saw in this poll was, you know, a solid majority of Texans saying that the country's headed in the wrong direction, right? You know, we see obviously in the MIPs that we mentioned, you know, concerns about, you know, political leadership. And we also see, I mean, I think this is important here, you know, concerns about just, you know, performance issues with respect to like state infrastructure, right? So all this stuff is kind of floating around out there. And one of the simplest answers, I'm sort of putting the wrapper around it before I describe it, but one of the simplest answers is to say, you know, maybe the institutions aren't working that well, right? And to be honest, as fancy as we are with our degrees and our, you know, whatever, it's like, yeah, it's a pretty good answer. I mean, it's certainly a good place to look, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a question that we've asked now three times, 2019, 2023, and 2026, kind of playing on the Churchillian sense. And we just say, do you agree or disagree with the following statement? Democracy is the best form of government. And then we ask how strongly you feel about that. And so we're not, you know, we're just, here we go. It's just sort of the alternatives, right? In 2019, 82% of Texans agreed with that proposition, 53% strongly. In 2023, it was 68%, 40% strongly. Today, it's 61%. 33% strongly. And there's 23% of Texans, so nearly one in four, who disagree with that proposition, that democracy is the best form of government. Now, what form of government they think, alternatively, I'm not asked, but like it just sort of points out that there's what I like to call, people usually like, a significant minority here are expressing, you know, a view that maybe that democracy is not the best form of government.
Right.
Now, interestingly, you know, there's another question we asked about the fundamental design and structure of the American government, essentially whether or not people think that it needs like significant change to work for current times or whether the design and structure work okay. And what's interesting is between 2019 and 2026, over the same time period, that really hasn't changed. 61% of people thought we needed significant changes in 2019. 57% believe we need significant changes today. But if you put those two things together, it could be kind of troubling, right? Because in 2019, when 61% thought we needed significant changes, 82% thought democracy was the best form of government. Now it's 61%, only a third strongly agree with that, and a quarter think we should do something else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's to say this is an ongoing, I mean, you know, I think, you know, looking at these results, you know, I'm much more open to some of the more hyperbolic warnings that come about the strength of democracy. I mean, you see these sorts of, you know, declining ratings of democracy in the U.S. And sometimes it's kind of easy as a professional, you know, to sort of discount certain aspects of that stuff, depending on what the various, you know, measurement pieces are. But I mean, as someone who studies public opinion and you look at this, you can kind of say like, well, you know, this is not going in the right direction.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that as I was thinking about those results when I first saw this, and we had talked about it a little bit, there's an interesting kind of contrast between, on one hand, what we've seen over the last 10 years, and particularly during the first Trump term, about, you know, the prevalence of concerns about the erosion of democracy and democratic institutions, put it that way. But in a very day-to-day kind of way, which is we've spent a lot of time going out. This is, see, here now we've really hit it.
Right.
And we're still seeing that in the Trump, in the second Trump term, and arguably with better justification, right?
Right.
But that road has been a little worn now, and there's been a little bit of a boy who cries wolf dynamic raised, particularly among Trump's critics, about how productive it was to declare the end of democracy every time the next threshold, right, or every time a norm is broken, something like that. And that grossly oversimplifies that, but
not terribly.
But nonetheless, what this kind of data, and we've seen some of this nationally, suggests is that one might argue that it's less the concrete steps themselves than the cumulative impact of the overall anxiety about it. That on one hand, yes, Trump did X and democracy went on and the system kept functioning, at least to the extent that it is, et cetera, and maybe we should chill out about it. But at the same time, it does seem like there is an overall impact going on here.
Yeah.
That same question here is with some of the other things we've talked about. How much of this is the general sense of anxiety out there in the environment that is really exacerbated by the economic situation right now?
Yeah.
Which has gotten worse since the war.
Yeah. And I think, the other thing to sort of acknowledge here is that, it's not clear from this question. And I think if we were to delve deeper, I don't think it would get any clearer what that alternative looks like. And so to the extent that, you sort of acknowledge these results, if you're a student of history and constitutions and all that kind of stuff, you're like, well, those are pretty tough. it's a pretty hard road to plow, right? I mean, like, that's not easy.
Right. We've been confronting this as we've been teaching the Intro to American Government course. How do you talk about these obviously signs of stress or erosion or whatever you want to call them without a clear way out, but that's part of the story.
Yeah, and so I think that even though you see this sort of growing discontent with democracy, I haven't seen any corollary growing embrace of a clear alternative, right? And so that is sort of the thing itself, which is I think you can sort of, unfortunately, more and more I get friends who say, yeah, but what can you tell me that will make me feel better? I think what this tells you is that, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way the government is operating right now, generally, whether in this particular administration, over the last couple of administrations, whether this has to be a reflection of the ineffectiveness of Congress and institutions or the court or where. I mean, like, look, there's a lot of places you could look. So it's not an unjustifiable position, but it also doesn't mean that when faced with actual alternatives, these people wouldn't say, no, actually, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'd rather these institutions work better than like some other ones. We just don't know. But I also don't think that this is like, again, the indication of a growing movement for something clearly, obviously, concretely different, because I don't think that exists.
So pivoting slightly, you guys asked an interesting question, and maybe these results are not as interesting as one might have hoped, or they're just confirmatory. But I was very interested when you were putting this together. We had talked about this a little bit. On the ratings of the different economic sectors and people's attribution of importance, and set that up and give us a sense of what you got. And the ratings are a little more important, or a little more interesting to me than the rankings.
Yeah, I heard that.
But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things we were trying to do in figuring this out, again, we're thinking about sort of the future of the state. We're thinking about infrastructure planning. We're thinking about, the mix of industries. And part of the thing that, I try to do is say, like, okay, well, what would be an interesting angle to bring the public into this discussion, right? Because ultimately, you start thinking about this, and really most of the time when you're thinking about survey questions, the first, like, six are, like, the bad ideas. You start thinking, like, oh, maybe we could figure out, like, we should ask people, whether the state should, this isn't the question, but just that's how we always say, this isn't the question, but it's, like, something along the lines of, should the state be, like, encouraging certain industries or not or whatever. And then you kind of get a step back and say, well, what normal person has any thought about, the state's involvement in, like, the construction industry? So you got to take a step back and say, let's just get a sense of, like, where people are, like, how do they view the state economy? How do they view the different sort of major business sectors and their contribution to the overall again, state economy. And so what we did was we said, you know, we did about, I want to say 12 to 16 different business sectors, including, you know, I think many of the big industries in Texas, but also some of the more kind of obviously prevalent, you know, to people, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the reasons that I was interested, and then we asked, you know, basically, is this very important, somewhat important, not very important, not at all important to the Texas economy? And then also, okay, now which of them is most important now that they've considered them all? And I think these questions, kinds of questions are very interesting because a lot of the time our discussion in the public sphere about the economy tends to center on industries that don't really make up huge shares of jobs or GDP or whatever, you know,
yeah.
We're constantly talking about like tech and manufacturing jobs. And in most cases, tech and manufacturing jobs are not, you know, majority of the jobs anywhere, you know, really. But it's, you know, because they're mostly retail jobs, just to say it out loud.
Right. But, and tech has been growing.
Yeah, no, it's been growing.
There's a lot of things to be said about that. Yeah,
no, and the point of that is not to say that that's not a growing industry. The point of that is to say that people's perceptions of where all the jobs are and the reality is actually usually simpler. It's like, no, it's all the people doing the retail things that you interact right. with. But
and for all those subtleties, number one response?
Oil and gas. Exactly. And that's the thing that's sort of funny is, you know, and interesting, right? At the end of the day, you know, when you say, when we just look at the share of Texans who said that this industry is very important. Oil and gas was the top, 72%. Healthcare next at 71%. Just below that, at 66% each, was farming and agriculture and education. Construction at 51%. Then you start going down to below 50% for each of these. Banking and finance, 46%. Then technology at 45. Alternative energy, 41. Real estate, 40. Aerospace, aviation, defense, 40. International trade, which is actually kind of big, 34%. Retail, yeah. 32. Restaurants, 28. That has to do a little bit with the Lyceum's focus. Travel and tourism, 28. And entertainment industry, 19. But yeah, again, oil and gas, farming, healthcare. I mean, the, you know, and I, like there's a reason the stereotype is the stereotype because people hold it, right? And it's not to right. say that this isn't a fair way to look at this, but it's also interesting that the industries that you'd think would crop to the top did.
It would be interesting to like take these rankings. You know, the public opinion mm-hmm. rankings in this poll, share of the labor force rankings,
yeah.
share of economic activity rankings,
yeah.
and see how they
yeah.
see how they match up.
Now, there's probably
know, the oil and gas thing is just so hilarious. I mean, it's a you need to send a copy of this poll to Taylor Sheridan because this poll could find its way into the dialogue into one of the Billy Bob Thornton speeches in Landman,
right.
like. You know, people can talk all they want about alternative energy, but oil and gas is still number one in Texas, and people know it.
Well, yeah.
I saw it in that Texas Lyceum poll.
Well, actually, one in three Texans, when said what is the most important industry, will say oil and gas.
It'd be the biggest cultural hit for the Texas Lyceum in the history of the organization.
Well, here you go. You heard it here first. And, hey, the data's out
Taylor,
there.
Yeah,
Taylor, data's free. Go grab it, you know.
At any rate, so, and all that, you know, but I think it also... There are things you can read into this that are interesting. I'm most interested in the mid-tier things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the top-tier things you can make sense.
Right.
Oil and gas, healthcare, farming and agriculture. Mm-hmm. You also bring up, you know, raise an interesting point is in terms of what we might, you know, making some kind of table of other indicators of yeah. the relative positions of these sectors. The place of these sectors in... You know, legislative subsidies and attention, and
yeah,
and you know, and the state's relatively recent and open embrace of industrial policy.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting to find banking and finance in that space as we open, you know, the taxi and all that stuff, right.
right?
I mean, Texas is moving really squarely into like kind of a banking finance position.
Well, and remember, you know, all the workforce alignment stuff a few years ago, very heavy on both healthcare. Which yeah, ranks highly, you know. But also on some of the tech stuff.
Yeah, and the health. I mean, the healthcare thing is. I mean, again, like it tracks in the sense of like you know. I mean, UT just got a huge donation to increase
yes.
its medical footprint. You know, I think the Dementia Prevention Research Institute of Texas is a huge thing. The cancer
right.
so that we've been doing is a huge thing. So I mean, it's not. That's like that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. All right. Before we run out of time, what else you want to highlight? What else is in here? I have a guess what you're going to call, but.
Oh.
What do you want to raise before we go?
Well, I think, you know, I'll do two things.
Sure.
Okay. One, you know, obviously let's
gives me two chances to be right.
Good. Okay. That's perfect. Well, one's pretty general, but I mentioned it to you before. I mean, the first I was going to say is, you know, we do have job evaluations of all of the major statewide leaders. We have evaluation of the president. You know, we see a shift in, views of the president, a major shift when it comes to immigration, his handling of immigration, which I think is an important thing just to pay attention to out there, right? I mean, in Texas, among Texas.
And what was the attrition like on that?
It was huge, actually. So let's see. He's down. He was at, so in 2025 on the issue of immigration and border security, he was at 58 approval, 42 disapproval, so plus 16. Today, he's at 41, 50, minus 9. So that's a 25-point net shift on that, you know, really what is a key issue. The other sort of notable thing, and this is just sort of, you know, one of my, just kind of interesting to me, are, you know, people, it's like, you know, because this is a survey of Texas adults, it doesn't mean we didn't ask for job approvals. Obviously, we also asked for some of the statewide leaders. We also looked at Ken Paxton and John Cornyn. Again, we're not looking at voters. We're not looking at primary voters. We're not looking at runoff voters. But that's actually what makes this so interesting, right? Because I think there's a really good reminder in this about the extent that, you know, while we've been talking about the differences between Ken Paxton and John Cornyn for what feels like a really long time, and while those two are, you know, really fighting hard for a very, very small sliver of the Republican electorate, who we've talked about has very, you know, divergent views on these two candidates. When we look at this broader population, there's almost no difference between them. And that's what I think is kind of funny here. So, you know, overall job approval for Ken Paxton, 36, disapproval, 41. Again, Texas adults, diverse, younger population. John Cornyn, 37, 39. That's statistically indistinguishable. Among Republicans, Paxton is 60 approved, 24 disapproved. Cornyn, 60, 23. Among conservatives, Paxton, 58, 25. Cornyn, 58, 23. So this is just a reminder. Once you, and this is really important, I mean, we've had all these discussions, but once you step outside of the very narrow share of people who are going to vote in these Republican primaries, this is something we've been talking about a long time. Most Republicans in the state have cast a ballot for both Ken Paxton and John Cornyn. And most will probably do it again if that's the candidate who ends up leading the ticket. And this is like a, just a little reminder of that.
But as of now, there's a real tension there.
Oh, yeah. There's a huge tension.
That I think is really...
It's going to take a lot of work to get there. And that's the important part.
And how are Abbott's numbers in your overall...
Abbott stayed... I think he had a little... Let me see. I've got it right here. So in 2025, he was at 55-46. And again, that was a pretty positive moment in time for Republicans in terms of the shift that was going on. Today, he's at 46-43. So he's still above water with the overall adult sample, which I think, you know, for him, again, with that sample, pretty good place to be. I mean, he's managed to maintain a relatively insulated position for himself, even amidst all of this kind of... movement, let's say, around some of the other major political figures.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about that you see there and we'll be watching in the next poll is that there's a couple of different dynamics I'm watching that are interesting. One is the Trump state leadership dynamic.
Right.
And it feels to me, and I've got to go back and look at this more closely, but that you know, we went through a period where, particularly in the first part of the honeymoonish part of the Trump second term, you had to pretty much, you could pretty much count on the fact that Trump's ratings were going to be 4 or 5, sometimes more points higher among Republicans than Abbott's.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, more than that, higher than everyone else.
Yeah.
Right. But now if we've got this really deeply divisive and ugly Senate primary going on, there's another factor going on here in which Republicans, you know, because Republicans are still figuring out who they're going to prefer, those that are paying attention, in the Cornyn-Paxton race, it's putting downward pressure on the whoever's going to be the Republican general election candidate. Because as you know, as your numbers showed there, and they're not very far off. I mean, the numbers are different, but the proportions and the overall dynamic is pretty similar in our RV polls. That there are significant chunks of Republicans right now who, as you say, by the time we get to October, may become reconciled to voting for the candidate they did not favor in the primary. But right now, they're not there.
No.
And that is showing up not just in the tryouts, but I think even more so in those favorability and job approval numbers, the ones you got there, the ones we're seeing, and that that race has now separated itself from the other statewide races that would otherwise, you know, the governor's race would be, you know, a big race. I'm not saying it's competitive or how, that's not a judgment on how competitive it is, but that would be a marquee race. But the Senate race, the Senate primary race, has just caused a lot of bad feeling among Republicans mm-hmm. that are not reconciled in this moment.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really, you know, helps Abbott in all of this is the fact that he's not bleeding independence in the same way that Trump is.
Right.
And that's something that's, you know, protecting.
So what does that look like?
Well, because I was going to say, you know, overall, Trump is still just slightly running better in terms of the job approval among Republican adults compared to Abbott.
Uh-huh.
But among independents, 62% disapprove of the job that Trump is doing. And among, for Abbott, it's 45.
Right.
That's where you're starting to see those. That's the problem. But that's also where, you know, that's where the question of, well, how close is the election kind of matter.
Right. You know? And independents are very negative on both Cornyn and Paxton, yeah. as I recall, without a whole lot of differentiation, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think Paxton might be a little bit more negative because of just, you know, all the unpleasantness that, you know, has right. gone on in recent years, but not much. You know, the only other thing I would mention in all this is, you know, as you go through a poll like this, you know, you look at a lot of crosstabs and you look at a lot of different points of data and, you know, historically, you know, you tend to find tons of differences between the parties, of course, but also, you know, sort of urban, suburban, rural splits. You tend to see more, you know, race and ethnicity splits. And I'll say, you know, the thing that really jumped out in this poll, and this is not an advertisement for college, but man, the difference between, you know, college and no college, and between, you know, an income split was above $75,000 and below $75,000 was pretty remarkable and pretty consistent across a lot of different parts of the poll. And I think that sort of speaks to, you know, the economic concern piece of this. But it also speaks to the fact that, you know, in general, when you're thinking about things about like job opportunities, home opportunities, ability yeah. to afford childcare, these sorts of structural fundamental things, it's still the case that, you know, the college degree helps. And when we talk about that question about, you know, do you think of your current
yeah.
job as a job or just a career, you know, a job to get you
just
by
a job career. Or a career. Yeah.
And the share of people with a college degree compared to those without who said it was a career was twice the number.
Of course.
Of course. And so it's sort of, you know, it's one of those things that's still floating around out there. And if anything, you know, but I would say as someone who's been looking at this for a long time, it's becoming more exacerbated. And some say what I would say is it's subsuming some of these other things that we're talking about, right? We have a very young, yeah. very diverse population that's going to need a lot of education, that's going to need jobs, it's going to need opportunities. And in some ways, you know, as the Republican Party has made, you know, some efforts to appeal more directly to elements within those groups, you know, you're seeing in some of these quality of life judgments less about partisanship and more about kind of stage of life, you know, and sort of overall,
yeah.
you know, sort of socioeconomic achievement up to this point.
Yeah, I mean, stage of life, I mean, there's this convergence of stage yeah. of life in part.
Yeah.
Education level, class.
Right.
Right. I mean, we call it by income, but.
Yeah. yeah. And the extent to which, you
I
know.
I mean, the education piece underlines the degree that this is not, you know, there's an interesting relationship right now between class and education levels. Yeah. Put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. Well, I thought you were going to mention Texans taking a vacation, but you opted to be much more serious.
Yeah,
so
I'm
I was
sorry.
Wrong.
Do you want me to? You should,
yeah. So go ahead.
Well, I'll just say the majority of Texans are not going on vacation this summer, 51%. And the main reason, of course, it's cost. Right. Yeah. I mean, ultimately about, you know, almost three in four Texans say, you know, cost is one of, if not the primary reason they will not be taking time off this summer, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, it's speaking of quality of life. I mean, it's a real thing. I mean, that sort of thing, you can kind of joke about it and all that. Yeah. Well, compared to housing and road and stuff, but it is a quality of life issue.
Taking a good trip makes you less grumpy about things.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that a lot of people have a lot of positive memories about taking a vacation. So,
yeah, I think that's right. All right. Well, good poll. Interesting.
Thanks.
Good talk.
Yeah. Thanks for talking about.
We'll put these files somewhere where you can reach them, and we'll link to them on the Texas Politics website. You can find them on the Texas Lyceum website as well. Or
it's very accessible.
I couldn't as of this morning, but I'm sure they're there now.
Yeah, I'm sure they're there. Texas Lyceum.
But we'll also, you know, if you want to just go to our website, or if you're listening to this at the website, we'll make sure that there are some links nearby so you can go directly to the files. So with that, thanks to Josh for coming back today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A lot going on, I know.
Yeah.
Thanks again to our excellent production team in the dev studio here in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. As always, thanks all of you for listening. Again, you can find some of the data we're talking about, much, much more, at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So thanks again for listening, and come back next week. We'll be back with another Second Reading podcast, and maybe even with a little breaking news. Who knows? Ooh.
Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.